And we don't want to say that it's exclusively this revelation. But this happens to be a pretty good one. We have it, at least have it in hand. It's not to say that there aren't tribes in North America that also had their revelation, and that the true words of Jesus, if we could know what they were, would also be this revelation, or the words of Abraham would also be this revelation, given to them by the intelligence of the universe. Why? To help us become what we're designed to be. Because otherwise we're left to our own imagination and egoism and fantasy. We are left, if left alone, we develop great theories like Freudianism and Marxism and, you know, behaviorism and et cetera, et cetera. Edifices which, you know, they start to build and build, and the taller they get, the more lopsided they are until they finally crash. So one way to understand revelation is guidance and counsel for developing and maturing the entity that the human being is in the most direct, comprehensive, and efficient way. You know, Rumi is so popular in America today for lots of reasons, but I think one of the reasons that he's kind of a remedy for the neuroses and wounds and split that has been so much a part of our own culture, a split between spirituality and humanness. And one of the reasons why Rumi is sort of, people are just drinking him in, is because he embodies this mentality. He grew out of this consciousness. He was totally in alignment with this truth, this revelation. And it's a truth, or it's a vision of the human being in which our spiritual development and our human development converge. And the whole of the human being is accepted as is. And from that point, we begin to refine and develop what the human being is. Our biggest problem is our nafs, our ego, our false self. And when we say ego or false self, we don't mean or pretend that the human being is ever going to be in a totally egoless state. But the Sufi conception is that we're always working with self. I mean, at one level it's called nafs, the compulsive, the nafsi amara, the compulsive or obsessive self. But there are seven levels of self typically described in most of the Sufi maps of the journey. And it's a refinement of the human self by gradually ridding it of its forms of enslavement and conditioning, slowly purifying it, gradually purifying it, so that the self can be responsive to spirit rather than a veil before true spirit. So the whole of this process, let's put it this way. The first thing that this revelation does to the mentality of the human being is to remind us that there's one thing we must remember, and that is what is most real. You can call it the divine, you can call it Allah, you can call it Haqq, truth, reality, but that we must keep this somehow at the center of our reality. Instead of our ego being the center of reality, take your ego out of the center and put Allah there. So when you see a beautiful ocean, you say, Alhamdulillah, or thank you, God. Or you see a beautiful child and you say, thank you, God. Or you make an intention for yourself and you say, God willing, you know that there's an intimate relationship between your individual human self and this infinite power and intelligence which will support you, which is your intelligence, which is your creativity, which is your strength. In fact, all the qualities you need to live are from this source, and the whole deal is to submit to it, to align with it, to transform the nafs so that the nafs is not just a continual form of resistance and resentment. Now, how do you do this? It's a great idea. We all agree upon it. Lots of people would agree upon it. How do we do it? Well, that's a big subject. But what becomes clear as you just take Rumi, for instance, who we all love so much. I trust you love him as much as I do. If you read Rumi, I mean, sometimes people distort it. I mean, translators and versioners of Rumi, there are distortions that creep in. But basically, the truth is there on every page, in every poem. Rumi is talking about one thing and one thing only. And he's passionate about one thing and one thing only. His passion is for this abundant and generous divine reality. He was awed by it. He loved it. He was intoxicated with it. And he wanted all of us to be in that same state. So one could say that the purpose of human life is also the means of undoing the slavery of the ego. The purpose of human life is to know and love God, to come into relationship with the real, to love it, to be in a worshipful relationship to it. And by when I say worship, we have to translate that word a little bit, because by worship we don't primarily mean a set of ritualized behaviors, but living in a state of wonder at God's signs, living in a state of reflection, living in a state of gratitude, appreciation, and praise. And this will begin to shrink the ego. This will begin to form the positive relationships and the humility in the individual soul that will continue to nourish further that humility, that surrender. That Islam, what we mean by Islam and what Sufis mean by Islam, is a state of being, a state of surrenderedness, a state of trust in God that is also active and dynamic. We have, in Sufism, we've always had two important centers of grace, I'd say. One center of grace is what I've been talking about so far. It's the revelation, the truth that came into the world, and it came in embodied in language. It came in a book. And the other center of grace is the completed human being. In other words, the human being who has matured in this truth, who becomes the living book. You have the revealed book, and you have the living book. In the very brief history of Sufism in the West, so far, most of us have focused on the saints and the masters of Sufism, the living book. And we have not yet fully grasped the relationship between these two things and how they nourish each other and support each other. Because it may be that the Sufi enlightenment may have its own characteristics. No enlightenment, this at least is what I've concluded. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I think there are different kinds of enlightenment. And, we like to say that all roads lead up the same mountain and get to the same place. And we like to respect, and we do respect, all paths to God, because as many people as there are that many paths to God, no doubt about it. Everybody is doing what they're supposed to be doing, hopefully. But it may be that Sufi enlightenment has some of its own characteristics, such as ishq, love, passionate love, zikr, remembrance, groundedness, integration with life, strong sense of community and relationship, the highest states achieved within a lived, practical human life. These are the characteristics of Sufism, which, by the way, are becoming more and more the characteristics of some other traditions as well. Buddhism in America in the 20th century, and I had this conversation with Jack Kornfield, he said, you know, Buddhism is becoming more of a layman's practice, more of a practice integrated with the world. It's changed from what it's been over many centuries. It's becoming more like Sufism, in fact. But we have at least 14 centuries of collective shared experience of this process. So a Rumi, an Ibn Arabi, a Moinuddin Chisti, etc., etc., these are exemplars. These are human beings who reached the level of God consciousness and integration that human beings are designed for. And they became the living Quran. They became the living book. And Sufism has grown out of this relationship. The Quran shaped them. They also unfolded the Quran and speak beautifully about it. Read Rumi's Fihi Ma Fihi, his discourses, or Rumi's Masnavi, you'll find on every page there are references, allusions to the Quran and Hadith and all of these things. So it is an integrated tradition that has at its center the divine, and it also has a vocabulary that is so powerful, so conceptually powerful, that as people on the Sufi path, as people who even in previous centuries converted to Islam in places like Africa, Indonesia, Turkey, India, China, etc., that they found these terms in the Quran untranslatable, and they inevitably slip into the language of the host country, because what was revealed was a language of incredible conceptual power. So, of course, the Persian poets slipped in a few of their own terms as well, like the beloved. We really owe that one very much to the Persian poets who also developed within this society. Although, actually, its roots are also in pre-Islamic Arabic poetry. But the idea of the beloved was elevated through Islam to another level altogether. It became much more than a romantic notion. So terms like zikr, the remembrance of God, which is the most important concept, the continual non-intellectual, non-analytic awareness that we are in the divine presence, is the fundamental practice of the Sufi tradition. But there are many other terms we could talk about, like intention, niyat, extremely important, taqwa, which is sort of vigilant mindfulness, iman, which we translate as faith, but it's a faith that is could be thought of as the certainty of the unseen and the beneficence of the unseen, and it's a certainty that's verified. It's not a belief, but it's a trust in the unseen that develops as you test it and experiment with it. Insan, the concept of the human being, which has several root meanings. The first meaning of it is nasiha, which means to perceive. The human being is a perceptive center of will. But the human being also, the second meaning of insan, the word for human being in Arabic, is the one who is capable of intimacy. You are the ones capable of intimacy with each other and with the divine. That's at the core of our humanness. And then there's a third meaning of somewhat uncertain derivation, but still it's related. The Sufis remind us of this, that insan also means the one who is forgetful. So we're both the heedless ones, and we're the ones who can establish intimacy, the ones who can perceive. Now, you want to hear what Rumi's teacher, what he had to say about some of this, Shams of Tabriz? He said some remarkable things. This is his, something from his conversations that were scribbled down in Konya 700 years ago. The particular book it comes from is kind of a mess, but there are gems in it, because it was just scribbled by people who were listening to what he had to say. The best person is the one who is furthest from his or her own desire. No matter how refined and mature his ideas are, he is further away if he has not left his own desires. Let me pause for a moment, because there's a possible misunderstanding in this, that another example where the tradition of Sufism and Islam is very, very human. Because the point is not to kill or stifle all human desires. That would be a waste of energy, and it would be destructive of our very humanness. There are some religious conceptions that propose such things, that total elimination of desires, as if that were possible. But no, the attitude of this tradition is to bring your desires into appropriate bounds, lawful bounds, and to not be enslaved, to not be a slave of your desires, or to not have your desires be unconscious factors in your actions. So I think that's what he means here. No matter how refined and mature your ideas are, your knowledge, if you're not far away from the slavery to your own desires, you're nowhere. I have a feeling that all the same issues we struggle with today, people were struggling with them in the 13th century too. Listen, he says, when people hear the words, do whatever of this path you want to do, they go to sleep. They content themselves with their ignorance and become lazy about their work. Let me pause again. This is the teacher of Rumi. This is the guy who set Rumi on fire. This is the guy who the people of Konya wanted to kill. He was pure spiritual power and beauty. But you know what they said about it? You know what he said? He said, some people say, I have a beautiful side and a wrathful side to my being. He says, but my wrathful side is more beautiful than my beautiful side. When people hear the words, do whatever you want, of this you want to do, they go to sleep, they become lazy about their work. All they hope for is to be saved by their last breath. And if someone says, what kind of religious law is this that causes desolation to people? Now he's talking about the work. What kind of religious law and work is this that causes desolation to people? We say, to lead them into a safety or security removed from this scary rigor, that's how I translate it, to lead them into an imagined security away from this rigor, which is sometimes frightening, to the knots, is 100,000 times more terrible. That would be actually be like throwing them down a well. And he says, if you walk this path, if you struggle on this way, working hard night and day, the way you will travel is right and real. Whereas the way of ease that some propose is like laying down in a bunny's nap. Are you merely an imitator of this way? Is this a false path? So much of the education of the Sufi path is a rigor that begins to shape and transform our nafs through surrender, through a healthy discipline of not always giving the nafs what it wants, but sometimes holding back, redirecting it, giving it a healthy discipline, not a pathological asceticism, but a healthy rigor and discipline. And we always have, you know, two tendencies in the spiritual life. Two, I think, complementary tendencies. And one of them we can call orthodoxy. And at this moment, I don't mean by that a bad word. And maybe there's a better word. Orthodoxy means right teaching. Let's call it right teaching. And on the other hand, we have the free-spirited Gnosticism of people like us, like Sufis. You know, we're the free-spirited, we're the spiritual freelancers, I mean, sometimes. So you have the orthodoxy and then you have the freelance spirituality. They're in tension, they're in reaction to each other. The beauty of the freelance spirituality is that you trust your heart, you trust your experience, you don't get encaged, boxed in. You keep it real and alive. The advantage of orthodoxy, I mean, orthodoxy can tend towards a certain kind of tyranny, but the main impulse of orthodoxy is the wish to preserve the rightness and the truth of the original revelation so that it doesn't get corrupted by the nafs. Let me tell you about Islamic orthodoxy and Islamic law. There are five major schools of law. And interestingly enough, their founders were people who suffered greatly for sticking to their own integrity. Many of them were tortured and killed, these founders of the Orthodox schools of law. They were the ones who resisted the political powers of the day to try and preserve the essence and the truth of the faith. Of course, they systematized it, they formulated it, and it got crystallized, it got sometimes a bit sclerosed, it got frozen in time, and then it got encrusted with even more stuff and patriarchy and all kinds of things that we really want no part of. But the original impulse was to have something to hold, a sort of, you know, keep true. That's the beauty of orthodoxy, or of this impulse in spirituality. Whereas sometimes it turns into a tyranny, it begins to oppress people, it begins to ask for outer, behavioral things rather than the essence of spirituality. But on the other hand, this freelance spirituality can also degenerate into a self-serving corruption of the pure mystical spirit to something that just serves the nafs and its convenience and its own consolation. And finally, you wind up with, well, in the 1970s, you may remember, there were certain spiritual teachings that became very attractive to people by offering pretty much an anything goes, freewheeling, eclectic, free love, hedonistic, let it all hang out, spirituality. I think as most of us realize, that did not lead very far. So there are always these two tendencies, and we see them in ourselves. And my wish today was to remind us of the purity at the heart of this revelation, its universality, its ability. And this is, if you become a friend of the Quran, you may find, I believe you will begin to find, that you go to it, as I go to it, when I really want to just sort of get things, get the cardinal points back again, because it has a way of cutting through so much of the illusion that the nafs creates, so much of the conditioning and distortions that worldliness, life in the world, allows to develop. It's a voice from beyond human personality that speaks to the most urgent, essential concerns of the human being, which is the well-being of our souls, and gives a reliable orientation to that. And the orientation is very simple. It's expressed in this very important verse from the Quran. Ila bi zikrillah tutmain kulub. Indeed, in the remembrance of God, hearts find tranquility. In the remembrance of God, rest, peace, wholeness. Because it's in that connection to that source of being that the human being derives his or her own integrity and wholeness and unity. And that's called Tawheed, the unity of existence, which is also the unity of the human being, when the human being has a strong heart. And the whole practice of Sufism is to strengthen the heart. Open up that inner presence that can meet outer life. Awaken in the human being the spiritual discernment that can see through the veils of appearances. I won't call it illusion. See through the veils of appearances to realize what is real, what is true, what is important, what is beautiful, and what is truly to be loved. And there's no greater pleasure than to live in that state of meaningfulness. There are so many lines in the Quran that just hit us with a power when we're open to hearing what's there. And then other times, I know people can read it and just think, oh, this just sounds like the Bible, or, you know, or what I heard in church. But here is something from Surah 65, verses 3 through 5. For the one who remains conscious of God, God always prepares a way of emergence. And he provides in ways one could never imagine. And if anyone places trust in God, God will be sufficient. For God will surely accomplish his purpose. Truly, for all things God has appointed an appropriate measure. And for everyone who is conscious of God, he provides ease by his order. All this is God's ordering impulse, which he has bestowed from above. And to everyone who is conscious of God, God will forgive our mistakes and will bestow an immense endowment. This is the message that comes from the infinite to us, to you, to me. Imagine what effect it could have on a human heart to be convinced of the reality of this and to live your life with that conviction, to know that God will be sufficient, that our trust, our reliance upon that divine power is the only thing we need to develop. And with it, it's actually not the only thing we need to develop, but with that, everything else will come. We will be led, as it was said earlier, stage by stage by stage. You will be led from darkness to light, from rawness to ripeness, from immaturity to maturity, from scatteredness to collectedness. And along the way, this frightening monster called the ego, the nafs, will become a beautiful servant, a willing servant. I wanted to share with you a little more zikr and movement and standing. Would you like to do that? Would you like to do something together in the way of practice and music? I know I could also ask for questions, but we've had a lot of words. Why don't we, and may I suggest that we take off our shoes? Would that be okay? And form a circle over here, or two circles, maybe a circle of an inner circle of men and an outer circle of women. And Huzoor, come in the center. This morning Llewellyn spoke about light. And he read you the light verse. And in the light verse, it says, Nurun ala Nur, light upon light. God is light upon light. And he even spoke about Najmuddin Kubra, who said, there are lights in the human being and there are lights from above. And these lights join, they can join. The light in you will draw down the light of spirit. So the zikr we're going to do and is going to be this, Nur ala Nur. The Arabic is actually Nurun ala Nur, but the un part we can leave off. It's just very slight. Nur ala Nur, light upon light. Nur, N-U-R, Allah, A-L-A. It's not Allah, the God, but Allah, a preposition meaning upon, Nur. And we're going to, now that we're in position, put your hands over, men over your solar plexus, ladies just beneath your breasts. And the movement here is going to be very simple. It's just a kind of rocking back and forth. I'm going to have Huzur bring us into the space with an improvisation on the ney. every other woman step into the circle. We're going to form three circles. Every other woman. And come in a little closer to the men. A little closer. Come in closer. Men, come in a little closer. Gods, but that which is God, truly divine.
Love.
Thank you all for joining together and listening patiently. For those who have any wish to ask some questions, I'm going to stay and sit on the stage there, and you're welcome to stay and talk a little more informally, and those of you who would like to leave or do whatever. Thank you so much. We also have a tradition of greeting people to our right and our left by taking their hands like this. See? Like that. And then kissing and saying thank you. So, as I said, I'll be here if anybody wants to talk. Thank you.